Thank you. Welcome to all the members and guests to what I think is going to be an exceptionally entertaining and instructive evening. Tom Keels is the author or co-author of 7 published books on Philadelphia history, including Wicked Philadelphia, Sin in the City of Brotherly Love, and Philadelphia Graveyards and Cemeteries, a subject to which I'll return in 3 sentences. Tom has appeared in numerous documentaries, including Franklin's Spark, an episode of the wonderful series Philadelphia, The Great Experiment, and Buried Stones, Buried Dreams, a feature on Mount Moriah Cemetery. He is, as a couple of those titles suggest, a confirmed tapophile. That is, a tombstone tourist. Which, by the way, is an enthusiasm I share. Tom has also made appearances on the Travel Channel, Radio Times, Action News, and other programs. He comes to us this evening to tell a Philadelphia story, Sesqui, Greed, Graft, and the Forgotten World's Fair of 1926. Like all Philadelphia stories, this one is filled with high aspirations, conflict, false starts, drama, larger-than-life characters, and of course, corruption on a heroic scale. Tom.
Good heavens, I have a lot to live up to after that wonderful introduction. I am very happy to be here tonight at the Athenaeum, where I am a shareholder, to talk about Sesqui, Greed, Graft, and the Forgotten World's Fair of 1926. In no small part because the staff here, especially Jill Lee, Bruce Laverty, Michael Seneca, and Jim Carroll, were incredibly helpful during the writing of this book and went out of their way to provide me with fascinating and worthwhile resources. Well, the Sesqui, for those of you who don't know, and it seems that's the majority of people in Philadelphia, was Philadelphia's second World's Fair and the very unsuccessful successor to the very successful centennial of 1876. Its full name was the 1926 Sesquicentennial International Exposition, which is why they had to shorten it. Sesqui is a Latinate term that means and a half. So a sesquicentennial is a centennial and a half, or 150 years. In this case, the 150 years between the signing of the Declaration of Independence and 1926. This promotional poster from the period shows a Hollywood starlet named Laura LaPlante, very snugly wrapped in the American flag, teetering atop the Liberty Bell, which was the official symbol of the Sesqui, and holding aloft in her shapely arms the wonders of the future fair, wonders that would turn out to be, for the most part, illusory. Let's just say that Laura's precarious perch is an apt metaphor for the fate of the fair. The Sesqui is a fascinating example of how the best intentions can be undone by political corruption, greed, hubris, plus enough rainy weather to capsize Noah's Ark. Although the Sesqui lasted a mere 7 months, it cast a long shadow over its host city. In many ways, 1926 was Philadelphia's high noon, both as a major American metropolis and as the workshop of the world. The ramifications of the Sesqui and the boss politics that would guarantee its failure would cast shadows over the city for the rest of the 20th century. Now, as many of you know, in 1876, Philadelphia hosted a World's Fair that set the standard for decades to come. The Centennial Exposition in West Fairmount Park attracted over 10 million visitors at a time when the entire population of the United States was less than 50 million. The Centennial was the first real international exposition in the United States, and it not only trumpeted America's status as an emerging world power, but it identified Philadelphia as a modern industrial city of the first order. These trade cards from the period show the 5 major buildings at the fair, including the one surviving structure, the Art Gallery or Memorial Hall, which today houses the Please Touch Museum. The directors of the Centennial included the most prominent and powerful men and women in Philadelphia. Among them was a 38-year-old merchant named John Wanamaker, who had founded a men and boys clothing store in 1861. Just before the Centennial opened, Wanamaker initiated his new store, the Grand Depot, at the corner of 13th and Market, directly across from where foundations were being dug for the new City Hall. It attracted so many World's Fair visitors that it became known as the Centennial Annex. Before long, Wanamaker was one of the wealthiest men in Philadelphia. The success of the Centennial would launch a series of international expositions in America and around the world over the next 50 years. Among the most notable was the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, also known as the White City, which would set Beaux-Arts architecture as the standard architectural style for the next 50 years or so. Then there was the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo in 1901, which everyone enjoyed except for President William McKinley, who was assassinated there. This was followed by the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Exposition in St. Louis and the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco. Each of these World's Fairs topped the previous ones in terms of technological innovation and fantastic architecture. Well, 40 years after the Centennial, department store magnate John Wanamaker thought that the time had come for his hometown to launch another World's Fair. Still going strong at 78, the philanthropist and former postmaster general was now Philadelphia's grand old man. His department store, now housed in a monumental palazzo designed by Daniel Burnham, the Wizard of the White City, was considered one of the largest and most luxurious in the world. In 1916, Wanamaker began to promote the idea of a sesquicentennial in 1926 to honor the Declaration of Independence. So we have Mr. Wanamaker to thank for that tongue-twisting name. Besides helping to heal a world that was being torn apart by a global conflict, Wanamaker also hoped that the sesquicentennial would both transform and reform his hometown. In 1916, Philadelphia was still the third largest city in America and still the workshop of the world. But Penn's green country town had been replaced by a grim, gray industrial city. By this time, the Schuylkill River was effectively an open sewer. Civic leaders hoped to jumpstart Philadelphia's renaissance with the Fairmount Parkway, today celebrating its centennial as the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, that was co-designed by Jacques Reber and Paul-Philippe Cray. The Fairmount Parkway was only the first of a number of planned projects that it was hoped would transform the gritty burg into Paris on the Schuylkill. Cret and Grébert hoped to replicate the parkway with other massive boulevards leading from Franklin, Washington, and Rittenhouse Squares. Wanamaker also hoped that the Sesqui would reform Philadelphia, which had gained a reputation as one of the most politically corrupt cities in America. Between 1876 and 1916, its municipal government had been overtaken by an omnipotent political machine known as the Republican Organization. In 1916, the organization's top dog was Boies Penrose, one of the biggest men, literally and figuratively, in the U.S. Senate. But Penrose's power was being challenged by two brothers from the swamps of South Philadelphia, Ed Vere on the right and his younger brother Bill Vere on the left. The two brothers grew up poor on a farm in the Neck, the rural lower section of South Philadelphia, described by one historian as the glory of the squatter who raised pigs, children, and hell in just about equal proportions. With their older brother George, who died in 1908, Ed and Bill Vere gained the patronage of the local political ward boss. With his help, they established a trash hauling business, which was a natural move since the Neck was the city's dumping ground. From there, they moved into street cleaning, using their political clout to gain about $20 million in contracts between 1890 and 1920. And just parenthetically, during this period, Philadelphia gained a reputation as having the dirtiest streets in America. Soon, the Bears had moved into construction and contracting. By 1916, the Dukes of South Philadelphia managed over $100 million in municipal contracts and were busy taking over City Hall. By now, Ed Fair was a member of the Pennsylvania Senate, while Bill Fair had moved from the City Council to the United States Congress. Meanwhile, John Wanamaker's plans for a second World's Fair in Philadelphia had been sidetracked by America's entry into the World War. But once the war ended, Wanamaker began to boost the sesqui once again. With his encouragement, French-born Paul-Philippe Cray, the head of the Department of Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, drafted a preliminary plan for the sesqui. Not surprisingly, his design centered along the new Fairmount Parkway. A triumphal entrance, let's see if this works, yes, at Logan Square, which had been reconfigured as Logan Circle, would lead to the fairgrounds. Logan Circle would be lined with magnificent new civic structures, not just a free library, but a hall of justice, a municipal hall, and a concert hall. The upper parkway would be lined with exposition buildings that, after the fair was over, would house all the major civic and cultural institutions in the city of Philadelphia. And of course, the giant cherry on top of this sundae would be a new museum of art atop the Fairmount Plateau. Moving a little further back, new bridges at Arch Street and across from the Art Museum would carry visitors past ornamental gardens and cascading fountains up to the zoo and to the old Centennial Grounds. The east side would be graced with more ornamental gardens leading from the new Art Museum and eventually culminating in a new civic stadium and athletic fields. Cray's visionary design would have transformed the northwestern quadrant of Philadelphia decades before the city turned its attention to it. And it also would have established the parkway early on as Philadelphia's answer to the Champs-Élysées. Sadly, these grand designs soon sank in the mire of Philadelphia politics. John Wanamaker, the sesqui's patron saint, died at the end of 1922. Mayor J. Hampton Moore was an enemy of the Vares and their organization. Meanwhile, nearly the entire city council was firmly in the Vares' pocket. So for the next 3 years, very little happened with the sesqui or with anything else in Philadelphia while the stalemate continued. The sesqui appeared dead in the water until the city's receiver of taxes, W. Freeland Kendrick, was elected mayor in November 1923. A suave, charismatic politician who was considered the best-dressed man in Philadelphia, Kendrick thought that the sesqui would do wonders not just for the city of Philadelphia, but for his own political career. He arranged to have himself elected president of the Moribund Sesquicentennial Exhibition Association, which he then proceeded to pack with as many fair allies as possible, including City Council President Charles Hull. The mayor announced that the sesqui would take place from June 1st to December 1st, 1926. He also made a surprise announcement about the fair's location. The sesquicentennial would take place not on the new Fairmount Parkway, but instead in and around League Island Park, just above the Navy Yard at the southern tip of Broad Street. League Island Park had been laid out by the Olmsted brothers just before World War I, but it had been pretty much abandoned once war broke out or once America joined the war. It was part of the South Philadelphia Improvements, a grandiose development scheme championed by Bill Fair when he was a councilman. The semi-developed park was adjacent to the Neck, which remained a marshy area dotted with shanties, ash heaps, and farms. It was still the most remote, desolate and poverty-stricken area in Philadelphia, and as you can see from this photo, also one of the wettest. There was only one paved street, Broad Street, connecting it with Center City, and one trolley line. In 1922, the city's leading architects and engineers had voted the Neck 13th out of 13 potential locations for the fair, giving the Parkway and Fairmount Park top marks. So, why was the fair moved? Well, like everything else in Philadelphia, Kendrick's decision was politically motivated. The new fair site was deep in the heart of the 1st Congressional District, aka Varesville. This was the domain of United States Congressman William S. Fair, who, after the deaths of Boies Penrose and his brother Ed, was now the undisputed political boss of Philadelphia. People refer to him as our local Mussolini. Kendrick had gotten his start in city government thanks to Ver. By moving the World's Fair to his district, Kendrick was delivering thousands of jobs to his political patrons' loyal constituents, along with infrastructural improvements like paved roads, streetlights, sewers, things like that. Ver also benefited because he owned a lot of land in the neighborhood, which immediately soared in value, while his construction company gained a number of lucrative contracts. Plans were drawn up for a new sesquicentennial at the foot of Broad Street. We're looking north here. This is the grand ceremonial entrance at what is now Marconi Plaza at Oregon Avenue, the main entrance at Packer Avenue, the main exhibition halls on the east side, the Gladway or entertainment area on the west, going down to a new stadium and to miscellaneous state and foreign pavilions, and ending up at the foot of Broad Street at the Navy Yard. John Molitor, the city's the city architect, who has been described by one architectural historian as a very gentlemanly alcoholic, suddenly found that he and his small staff were now responsible for designing the Sesqui grounds and the major buildings. He was assisted by a small staff, including a recent graduate from the University of Pennsylvania named Louis I. Kahn. Now, Kahn would later describe himself as the chief of design for the Sesqui, but according to the materials I've read, his actual title was architectural designer. In this role, he drew preliminary designs and layouts for several of the projected buildings, including these for a Palace of Liberal Arts. His major contribution to the Sesqui would be an independent project, a Palace of Fashion sponsored by New York clothing manufacturers. As a matter of fact, John Molitor nearly fired Kahn because he was spending too much time on this freelance project and not enough designing the main palaces. You can understand why. There's the Palace of Fashion. You can understand why, because the main palaces were pretty darn boring. They were basically large boxes, exhibition halls, with minimal decoration and ornamentation, painted pastel colors, and lit at night with illuminated lights. Only the towers were where ornamentation really went full out on these buildings. The first thing Sesqui visitors would encounter would be an 80-foot-tall, 42-ton replica of the Liberty Bell, illuminated with 26,000 light bulbs. This gigantic bell would straddle South Broad Street at Oregon Avenue at what is now Marconi Plaza. Once inside the fairgrounds, visitors would encounter the second wonder of the Sesqui, the 175-foot-tall Tower of Light. From its rounded dome, the Light of Independence, made of the two largest searchlights ever built, would turn night into day for miles around. The fair's permanent legacy would include a new stadium designed by Simon & Simon, seating 100,000. And this had been a major priority for Philadelphia for years. It had lost the Army-Navy game, what was the Super Bowl of its time, about 10 years earlier to New York, because Franklin Field was simply too small for the crowds. But before ground could be broken for any of these marvels, the marshy land of League Island Park had to be drained and roughly 2 million cubic yards of landfill brought in. Not a problem. We're building a new subway up on North Broad Street, so we'll simply pay the contractor to buy our own land back at about $1.25, $1.50 per cubic yard, and they will cart it from one end of Broad Street to the other. Needless to say, not only did this delay construction for months, but it almost bankrupted the fair before a single building went up. This is an aerial view of the Sesqui grounds. Looking north, this is Oregon Avenue up to City Hall along Broad Street at the end of 1925, when the fair was supposed to open in about 6 months. As you can see, not a lot of buildings. They're still bringing in land. At this time, the Sesqui had not received a single dollar from either the federal government or from the state of Pennsylvania. The city had spent over $10 million to date, but most of it had gone into site preparation. At the end of 1925, Albert M. Greenfield, the city's leading realtor and a good friend of Bill Vare's, and also the Sesquifinance director, led a bond drive which raised over $3 million from local businesses and individuals. This allowed construction to begin on the Liberty Bell and the main palaces, but it only covered a small portion of the fair's $20 million budget. Congress waited until March 1926 to allocate $3 million in federal aid, most of which was earmarked for its own structures. The Sesqui had been hoping for $10 million or more. Resistance to the fair was strong among Democratic congressmen, who basically saw the entire project as a big boondoggle by the Republican organization. The Sesqui also got little help from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Bill Vare conducted a running feud with Gifford Pinchot, the reform-minded governor of the state. Just as the Sesqui was starting, Vare ran against Pinchot and a third party, for the Republican nomination for the United States Senator from Pennsylvania, and he won. He would go on to win the election, but he would never be seated. That's the next book. Come back in a few years and I'll tell you that story. But in the meantime, Pinchot made sure that not one cent of state funds went to support the Sesqui in general. The bulk of the Sesqui's cost would have to come from either more private donations or from the cash-strapped city treasury. Not surprisingly, many corners were cut, especially after it was discovered that John Molitor had underestimated the cost of the main Sesqui structures by over $5 million. He was quietly retired from the project. Plans were canceled for many projects, including Louis Kahn's Palace of Fashion. Months before the Sesqui opened, the Inquirer published a report investigating shoddy business building practices at the new Sesqui Stadium. Mayor Kendrick took to riding around the fairgrounds on horseback, supervising construction and reassuring passersby that all was well. Now, by this time, many people, including members of his cabinet, were begging him to postpone the fair for a year till 1927, and this was common practice. The 1893 Chicago Fair was originally scheduled for 1892. The 1904 St. Louis Fair for 1903, both were huge successes. Despite the fact that the congressmen from Washington were telling him that the federal government would probably give another $5 to $10 million in aid if he waited a year, Kendrick refused to budge. As a matter of fact, he moved up opening day 24 hours from June the 1st to May 31st. Why? He was a former imperial potentate of the Imperial Order of the Mystic Shrine. That's Shriners to you and me. And this sheet music, they wrote sheet music about Shriners and Masons back then. This shows him in his wonderful potentate's robes. Kendrick had invited his brother Shriners to hold their national convention in Philadelphia, promising to open the Sesqui on May 31st, Memorial Day, the same day they were beginning their convention. And he promised to devote the first 3 days of the fair to them. So the Sesqui was going to open on May 31st, come hell or high water. And it did, with a little of both. That Monday, thousands of Shriners from around the country attended the Sesqui opening, and they helped to augment a paltry crowd of about 20,000 spectators. An early morning thunderstorm had chased many people away. At Oregon Avenue, raincoat-clad visitors watched the inaugural parade pass beneath a Liberty Bell that was still shrouded in scaffolding. In 1876, the high-powered duo of President Ulysses Grant and Emperor Dom Pedro of Brazil had opened the centennial. In 1926, the star attractions were Secretary of State Frank Kellogg at Center and Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover at Wright, neither of whom could be described as a scintillating speaker. Neither President Calvin Coolidge nor Governor Pinchot attended opening day. The only moment of the first day that really seemed to capture the public's imagination occurred after dark, when the giant Liberty Bell was illuminated and its 26,000 gold, amber, rose, brown light bulbs all, you know, came into life and created this shimmering globe of color that could be seen as far north as City Hall. But little else about the Sesqui during its opening days was really that inspirational. The only fully operational pavilion was the government post office. you could mail a letter and watch it get canceled. The large palaces were nearly empty, except for workmen who were busy unpacking a sea of shipping crates, and ground hadn't even been broken yet for many of the smaller structures. After 3 days, the 250,000 Shriners went home and told their friends and neighbors across America, "Don't bother with Kendrick's carnival. It was a PR disaster from which the fair would never recover." Only 271,000 people visited the fair during its first full month. They had been expecting between 5 and 6 million. Well, after its disastrous debut, the Sesqui did actually pull itself together. By late July, most of its exhibits were up and running. But there always existed a gap between the gleaming vision of the fair and its rather mundane reality. This photograph shows the main entrance at Packer Avenue below the Liberty Bell on a typical day. As you can see, it's not exactly a beehive of activity. But add some hand-painted colors, draw in half a dozen airships, and voila, Tomorrowland. What I love about Sesqui postcards is that it always looks like there's a dogfight going on overhead. They all have all of these zeppelins and biplanes drawn in to show how the fair was celebrating modern technology. Below Packer Avenue, Broad Street widened into the Forum of the Founders. This was flanked on the east by the two main palaces, the Palace of Liberal Arts and Manufactures and the Palace of Agriculture and Foreign Exhibits. Again, this is the official hand-tinted view, and this is how it appeared in reality. Now, you may notice in the background a rather unusual structure, looks sort of like a fire warden's tower. This got airbrushed out of most official photographs. This is all that ever got built of the much-vaunted Tower of Light. The Sesqui planners simply got this far by the end of July. The city ran out of money and said, "That's it." They stuck a little flashlight on top, and that was the light of independence. This skeletal structure would loom over the central plaza of the Sesqui until its end. Unfortunately, since so much material had been printed in advance, the ghost of the tower that never was would haunt fair visitors until nearly closing day. Now, what amazes me is that it took over $365,000 in 1926 currency to bring the tower to that rudimentary stage. That equates to about $4.5 million today. And you can still build a pretty nice 200-foot tower for $4.5 million. But this gives you some idea of the padding and the graft and the corruption that went on with Sesqui planning and construction. The Palace of Liberal Arts and Manufactures housed the output of American factories in fanciful booths, much as World Fairs had since the 1876 centennial. At the Boyertown Casket Company's Egyptian Mausoleum, you could buy a solid bronze casket with Canton crepe upholstery, similar to the one in which the late Chinese president, Dr. Sun Yat-sen, had rested for the past 16 months. The Palace of Agriculture and Foreign Exhibits housed the handful of foreign displays that allowed the Sesqui to call itself a World's Fair. At the lower right, we see Mayor and Mrs. Kendrick in front of the Japanese exhibit. The Palace of Fine Arts was home to 10,000 works of art by American and foreign artists. On display were over 100 works by the late French sculptor Auguste Rodin, which had been collected by Sesqui director and theater magnate Jules Mastbaum. And of course, after the fair was over, these would move to a new museum designed by Clay and Greber, forgive the accent, on the new parkway. The Civic Auditorium seated 10,000 and boasted a magnificent organ, which had cost over $150,000. While the main palaces were fairly generic in design, there were a few smaller structures did show some real architectural merit. For instance, the Pennsylvania Building, designed by modernist architect Ralph Banker, was considered the architectural gem of the fair. The rectangular structure of rose-tinted stucco was built around a central courtyard. The completed building contained works of art by Pennsylvania's leading artists, including Violet Oakley, Alexander Sterling Calder, and Daniel Garber. The Illinois State Building, designed by Chicago modernist architect Andrew Ribori, also stood out from the crowd. And then there was the Persian Pavilion, designed by Philadelphia architect Carl Ziegler. Unfortunately, all of the mosaic work, the beautiful detailing, took so long that this was one of the last buildings to open at the Sesqui. It opened when the fair had about 3 weeks left to run. One of the most popular exhibits was the High Street of 1776, an imaginative recreation of a Revolutionary-era Market Street lined with replicas of 22 historic yet vanished structures. This exhibit was sponsored by the Women's Committee of the Sesqui. These socially prominent women were among the few Philadelphians who were willing to stand up to the Republican organization that controlled the rest of the fair. To create the street, the Women's Committee hired three architects, all of whom enjoyed excellent credentials among Philadelphia's upper crust. Richardson Brongniart Oakey, who would later redesign the Betsy Ross House, E. Parrott Bissell, and John P. B. Sinclair. High Street was bookended with the old town hall and courthouse at one end and the Jersey Farmers Market with its cornucopias at the other. In between were 20 historic buildings, including Ben Franklin's print shop, William Penn's slate roof house, the Jefferson Declaration House, the President's Mansion, and many others. Dedicated on June 5th, High Street became one of the most popular exhibits at the Sesqui, attracting over 5,000 visitors a day. Thanks to the skillful management of the Women's Committee, it was also one of the few attractions at the Sesqui that actually turned a profit. Not far from the street stood Sulgrave Manor, a replica of the ancestral English home of the Washington family, sponsored by the National Society of the Colonial Dames of America. On July 5, 1926, President Coolidge dedicated the Sesqui before a crowd of 40,000 at the new stadium. Coolidge came on July the 5th because July the 4th, Independence Day, was not only his birthday, it was also a Sunday. Thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of deeply religious Americans were furious with the Sesqui for daring to open on the Sabbath, even for something as important as Independence Day, and they boycotted the fair. By waiting a day, Coolidge managed to bypass the entire political mishigas. His timing was perfect. On Independence Day, a heavy rainstorm wrecked the Sesqui, washing away roads and damaging buildings. Workmen had to cut a hole in the flat roof of the Palace of Agriculture because so much water had collected that the entire building was in danger of collapse. The resulting cascade demolished many of the exhibits below. Needless to say, many religious Americans thought that this was God's punishment on the wicked fair. The Sesqui holds the record as being the most waterlogged World's Fair ever. It rained on 107 of its 184 days, including 19. At a certain point, you have to think, okay, they did build this fair on top of a desecrated Indian burial mound. There is no other explanation. Needless to say, by the end of August, many of the hastily assembled structures were crumbling under the constant barrage of moisture. Perhaps the fair's desperate financial situation explains why its managers put out the red carpet to the Ku Klux Klan, then enjoying a resurgence that saw its membership top 5 million. In 1925, the Klan had held its annual Klonvocation, with a K, in Washington, where you had 50,000 Klansmen marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. In 1926, they hoped to repeat the experience on South Broad Street, marching down to the Sesqui Fairgrounds and burning a giant cross. And they did this with the blessing of the mayor and the Sesqui managers, or they were invited to do it. And by the way, lest you think that the Klan was strictly a Southern phenomenon, in the 1920s, Philadelphia had over 20 Klan chapters, or claverns, scattered around the city. These were run by a ruthless individual named Paul Mears Winter, who lived in Narberth. When news of the Klonvocation became public, just before the fair opened, religious leaders around the country protested. When Kendrick still refused to revoke the invitation, Rabbi Louis Wolsey of Congregation Rodef Shalom in Philadelphia drafted a public letter to Kendrick in which he stated with perfect courtesy that the mayor may not have noticed that the tenets held by the Klan ran somewhat counter to the values espoused by the Declaration of Independence that was being celebrated at the Sesqui. At this point, Kendrick caved and banned the Klan from the Sesqui. course, this was of little comfort to John C. Asbury, the chairman of the Committee on Negro Activities, who is basically funding all black activities at the fair out of his own pocket. It took a petition by black leaders to the White House to get the Sesqui Committee to dole out a meager $12,500 to fund African-American programs at the Sesqui. Well, despite all of these controversies, there were actually fun things to do and see at the Sesqui. On September 23rd, the stadium hosted over 120,000 spectators who watched Gene Tunney defeat Jack Dempsey for the World Heavyweight Boxing title. And guess what? It was raining. This was the one night during the entire Sesqui when it was impossible to find a hotel room anywhere in Philadelphia. About 10 days later, nearly 126,000 Catholics attended High Mass at the same stadium, celebrated by Cardinal Daugherty. At the Spanish Pavilion, visitors could enjoy rare paintings by Goya and Velazquez. The Japanese displays of art, dancing, and theater fascinated Americans as much in 1926 as they had in 1876. At the Palace of Fine Arts, you could enjoy not just Rodin, but such then little-known artists as Matisse, Kandinsky, and Picasso. A steady stream of celebrities enlivened Philadelphia during the Sesqui summer. Everyone from English channel swimmer Gertrude Ederle to silent screen siren Gloria Swanson setting off a cannon at Wright, March King John Philip Sousa, Crown Prince Gustav Adolf of Sweden, and even Her Serene Highness Queen Marie of Romania. On steamy days, visitors could take a cool gondola ride on Edgewater Lake, serenaded by genuine Venetian gondoliers. On balmy summer nights, a system of ornamental lighting turned the Sesqui into a true rainbow city, where couples could dance the Charleston under the stars and win a silver cup. But after rising throughout the summer, attendance plummeted after September. Talk of continuing the fair into 1927 was abandoned, although Kendrick did convince fair managers to keep the fair open an additional month, until January 1st, 1927. But most exhibitors were packing up by mid-November. When the Sesqui breathed its last at midnight on December 31st, 1926, it was a ghost town. Paid admissions totaled 4.6 million. This was less than half of the number of paying visitors at the 1876 centennial, even though the US population had nearly tripled in the intervening 50 years. At first, Sesqui officials announced that the fair would run a modest deficit of $200,000, but then all of the padded bills began to pour in. By early 1927, the size of the Sesqui deficit had topped $6 million. Unable to cope, the Sesqui Centennial Exhibition Association declared bankruptcy. To pay the bills, the city government held the Great Fire Sale of 1927. A massive auction of Sesqui structures and fixtures at the desolate fairgrounds. The Sesqui managers had spent nearly $7 million on the fair's five main palaces. The combined auction price was $52,701, less than 1%. Now, you don't expect salvage costs to bring back your entire outlay, but you do hope they might get between, say, 10 and 15%, maybe 20%, not less than 1%. All of the buildings were demolished almost immediately after their sale, the better critics charged to hide the real cost of their padded construction. The Austin organ in the auditorium, which had cost over $150,000, was almost sold to a curio dealer for $1,250. At the last moment, publisher Cyrus Curtis swooped in, bought it for $75,000, and gave it to the University of Pennsylvania. Today, it resides in the Irvine Auditorium. The Pennsylvania State Building, considered, as I said, the architectural gem of the fair, sold for less than $10,000. It had cost over $500,000 to build. Outgoing Governor Gifford Pinchot rushed to make sure that the building was demolished before he left office, afraid that it might become a permanent fixture in Vare-dominated Philadelphia. All 22 buildings of the High Street of 1776 sold for $1,750. The Sesqui's two landmarks, the Tower of Light and the Liberty Bell, suffered especially ignoble fates. The Tower of Light, by now known as the Light That Failed, fetched $1,050. As I mentioned, it had cost the city over $365,000. And then we have the giant Liberty Bell, which had cost over $100,000. What am I bid for this beautiful Liberty Bell? Miles of copper wiring, 26,000 light bulbs. Do I hear $5,000? Do I hear $1,000? $100? $60? Local residents were actually glad to see it go because after the fair ended, its hollow stanchions had become a thriving hobo hotel. In 1934, a newspaper reporter visited the Sesqui site on the 8th anniversary of the fair. She found a bleak, desolate landscape where the only relics of the fair were the rarely used municipal stadium and a couple of automobile graveyards on the concrete floors of the old palaces. Meanwhile, Chicago was wrapping up the second year of its wildly successful and profitable World's Fair, the Century of Progress Exposition. In an act of architectural karma, the landmark structure in Chicago was the Hall of Science. This was designed by Paul-Philippe Cret, whose visionary design for the Philadelphia Fair had been jettisoned by the Republican organization. Now, what's the bottom line on all this? Well, officially, Philadelphia spent $33 million on the Sesqui and suffered an on-the-books loss of $10 million. Adjusted for simple inflation, we're talking about $434 million and a loss of $106. But if you factor in labor cost, then things get interesting. The real cost, I would estimate, is anywhere from 3 to 4 times the figures. We will never know because there were so many backhanded deals, financial finagling, things like that. Well, City Hall was able to cover the deficit with more bond issues, going deeper into debt, and also by borrowing money allocated to other projects. The sesquicentennial is a major reason why there are no rapid transit lines to either Northwest Philadelphia or the far Northeast, and why Ralph Geary recently converted what was supposed to be the Art Museum subway station into art galleries. It also explains why Philadelphia water tasted like a chlorine cocktail until well into the 1960s. But the runaway cost of the Sesqui, combined with those of the Parkway and Art Museum, the Broad Street Subway, the Free Library, the Delaware River Bridge, the Byberry State Hospital, and other high-budget, high-profile projects of the 20s, would drive Philadelphia to insolvency by 1928. While the rest of the country was basking in Coolidge prosperity, Philadelphia was trying to scrape together money to pay its policemen and firemen. Sadly, this fiscal crisis coincided with a collapse in the real estate market and a slowdown in local manufacturing. Months before the stock market crash, unemployment in Philadelphia topped 10%, nearly 3 times the national average. Well before Hooverville had entered the English language, camps for the homeless were springing up on the former Sesqui site and on the Schuylkill riverbanks below the new art museum. More importantly, the sesquicentennial, described by one wag as the flop heard round the world, left deep scars on the Philadelphia psyche long before the stock market crashed. Before the Sesqui, Philadelphia was a dull, gray, grim industrial city, but it was a city that got things done. It was a city that could build the Hog Island shipyard, the biggest shipyard in the world, in a matter of months during the Great War. After the Sesqui, Philadelphia was a joke. And sadly, its condition would simply continue to fray as the economy soured during the 1930s. Over the years, the Sesqui site has been whittled away, with the exception of FDR Park, as the remaining section of League Island Park was renamed in the late 1940s. It bears some resemblance to its Sesqui footprint, with Edgewater Lake, the swimming pool, and the lagoon clearly recognizable. But the former pavilions and palaces have been replaced by playing fields and recreation centers in what is now one of Philadelphia's busiest parks. Few signs of the Sesqui remain. The Sesqui, or Municipal Stadium, renamed JFK Stadium in 1964, survived until 1922, home to Army-Navy games and rock concerts. Today, the Wells Fargo Center stands on the site. The Lookout Gazebo, itself a holdover from the 1912 Olmsted Brothers redesign, still survives, as does the nearby boathouse. The Sesqui Police Station still survives and is used by FDR Park staff. There's the American-Swedish Historical Museum on Patterson Avenue. It's not really fair to call this a Sesqui survivor, though. Its cornerstone was laid in 1926, but it didn't open until years after the fair ended. Other traces of the Sesqui can be found further afield. Sellgrave Manor was purchased by real estate magnate and state senator George Woodward. He had it moved to Chestnut Hill, West Willow Grove Avenue, where it was rebuilt with an exterior of wissahickon schist and became an elegant private residence. And then behind the Museum of Art is the Fountain of the Seahorses, a sesquicentennial gift from Mussolini's Italy. Actually, this was also a latecomer. It came during the Sesqui. The boxes got stored in a pavilion, in a warehouse somewhere. They found it after the Sesqui, and they said, let's put it behind the new art museum. It's pretty. Well, in conclusion, I just want to mention briefly, despite Philadelphia's checkered record with World's Fairs, let's not even mention the bicentennial, a group of brave souls are banding together to prepare for another major celebration in 2026, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. They formed an organization called USA 250. USA 250 is led by Executive Director John Grabel Herman at the left and Chairman Andrew Hones at the right, shown here with local congressional leaders. I think this is a great idea, I'm all for it, but there is one thing that is really freaking me out. Semi-quincentennial. Dear God, people, have you learned nothing from the past? One syllable more than sesquicentennial. And I'm sorry, but shortening it to semi-quin doesn't make any difference. Well, at any rate, plans, as you might expect for USA 250, are still in their initial stages. Already, Hones and his colleagues are eschewing traditional World's Fair attractions. Instead, they're proposing various activities, like having the city host an international symposium on democracy, or convincing the US Congress to hold a special legislative session in Independence Hall. State governments would be challenged to set goals for improving areas such as children's health and the environment between now and 2026. The ultimate goals, in Hone's words, would be, quote, to rekindle a sense of mission in our nation's message and chart a course that is steady and thoughtful into the future, unquote. So, will USA 250 join the centennial as one of Philadelphia's finest moments? Will it rank with the sesquicentennial is one of its less fine moments, or will it fall somewhere in between? You're going to have to come back in a decade when I've written the sequel to it. Thank you.